Welcome to Slow News Day with Kevin Clark. I am Kevin Clark.
Yeah.
We're doing a new recording setup, so it took Richie a half beat longer to say yeah than normal. Hey, Richie?
That's right.
All right. So here's the deal. This is really the first off-season SND on the feed. We started right before the season, so it's been football, football, football. We're going to continue that theme today, but we're just going to fill this feed up with just stuff I'm generally curious about. Lindsay will be on a bunch. She is traveling abroad, as we talked about last week, so she'll be gone for a few episodes. So what we do have is Patrick Doherty, who works for Roto World. You know him as Roto Pat. He ranked the top coaches in the NFL. We just go through that. We have a discussion on just what makes a good coach in 2023. Really, really enjoyed this one. And then Ben Fisher from Sports Business Journal joins to talk about the Snyder ownership change, the state of play in modern NFL ownership, how the prices are affecting everything, what kind of owner Josh Harris will be. I learned a lot from this, and he actually floated some teams that might be for sale, eyeball emoji. It was speculation, but I just think that there's some meat behind it. So great discussions with Pat and Ben. Let's get to it.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Joined now by Patrick Doherty from Roto World. What's going on, brother? Roto Pat.
I'm doing well. My local nine, the Zoomers call that a baseball team. We're up to 17-25, the St. Louis Cardinals. So things are looking really up for me right now.
So I've been watching more baseball now as a dad with a couch. And I used to love baseball. It's my favorite thing in the world when I was in high school. Coincidentally, when I had more time, I just kind of sit around watching extra innings, you know. And also I hated going to school. So the idea of games happening in the day and then also games happening till like 1 a.m. and you're just watching Eric Gagne close it out at Dodger Stadium. Like that appealed to me. And now I'm back and I used to be like really into analytics. All I want to do with baseball, Pat, is just be a dumbass fan. Like all this stuff, like I haven't watched in about a decade, and I watch the big games, but like I don't want to know anything about launch angle. I don't want to know any of these things. I just want to be a dumbass and talk about clutch hitting. Like I want to regress from where I was a decade ago.
See, you don't want to know how the dingers are made. And yeah, clutch hitting was like totally dead because of the shift. Cause like a clutch hit used to be, you just rip a single up the middle, but like during the low point of the shift years, like that hit just didn't exist anymore. Colton Wong was always just standing right behind second base. And like, so like the satisfying up the middle hit was just gone. It's like, you know, the kind of guys who didn't have power, like someone like Daniel Descalso, that's what he would do. He would hit it up the middle. That's how they became known as like clutch. So they had no power, but they're always hitting well-timed hits up the middle. And that was just dead with the shift, but now we're hoping it's coming back. So if you want to be a meathead baseball fan, I think you're getting back on the train.
Dude, I am so excited to be a meathead baseball fan. And when my kid is of age, I'll teach him about clutch hitting and how teams win in the playoffs because they want it more. And now the game changes, all that stuff. In the playoffs, October is just different.
You know, with baseball, by the way, we're super into trivia. I was meaning to ask you about fatherhood. I'll ask you a trivia question. How many kids do I have?
I believe it's 4, right?
Oh my gosh. I can't believe you know.
About this months ago because you had your 4th when I had my 1st.
That's right. I've started to tell people my go-to line. My go-to line is, it's like Taysom Hill's age, whatever your guess is, pump it up 2 or 3. And that's how many I have.
This happens when you like baseball. You just have 4 kids all of a sudden.
It's way too much.
Assigned more kids. Where the baseball, Rob Manfred's like, this guy loves baseball. Just saddle him with more kids. He's got time. All right, we're doing our top coaches. And we're not really going to do a list. You have a list, and I want to go through it, and I want to argue with you or talk about it conceptually about what this is. I do find it funny. Let's start with your worst coaches. Josh McDaniels, among the non-new coaches, is dead last. He's 27th. I think Josh McDaniels is not a particularly good coach. I've never, And these exercises are great, Pat, because sometimes I'm just like, well, Josh Daniels isn't the worst coach in football. And then you look at it and it's like, wait, maybe he is. Like, who's worse? You know, like, and I think sometimes we get into like the, you know, and every once in a while, there's kind of a punching bag like Gus Bradley, who's always going to be perennially at the bottom of his list. Yes. I think owners, I love the phrase Cooper Patagna used about recruiting a couple weeks ago, and I'm using it all over in life, which is, I think that teams are missing smarter now in a lot of ways. And so there's not going to be like a Gus Bradley who's getting unlimited patience in some of these things, or Matt Rhule, where it's just not going to work. And they're just like, whatever, we owe him $40 million. So we might as well keep him 2 extra years. So I do think there's an element of like these that the worst, I know I'm going to say something incredibly stupid here. I think the worst coaches now are better than the worst coaches a decade ago.
Zero doubt. And missing smarter is like a really, really good way to put it, because I think the best way to make your head coaching hire, I think you should always begin with someone who's an offensive play caller. You should make exceptions, of course, because there are true defensive geniuses out there. There's been some true defensive geniuses just hired in the past 5 or 6 years. But you know, the hottest commodity, the most difficult commodity to find, is a good play caller. And so even when you're a good coach who's not an offensive play caller, you're always in danger of losing your play caller. So I think like the platonic ideal is you hire an offensive play caller as head coach. Since Sean McVay was hired, 27 of 42 hires have been from the offensive side of the ball. 17% alone have been from either the McVay or Kyle Shanahan tree. And as we know, it's skewing. I know, it's crazy. And we know it's skewing way younger, and not that us young people are any smarter, but teams are taking much bigger swings. They're much riskier. Mike McDaniel would have been like the riskiest hire in the history of professional sports 10 years ago. And now people are kind of like, wow, that's kind of interesting. But like no one really even bats an eye.
But whatever.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a little weird.
I will say that
now.
young people are smarter now that I believe in clutch hitting again. Why is Josh McDaniels your worst ranked coach?
First, didn't seem like he learned anything from his Broncos go around. And like, I think his worst trait, and maybe I'm just projecting this onto him, it seems, I wrote something like this in the article, it seems like he resents anyone who had the audacity to like be successful before he got there. And as we know, the first thing he did as Broncos head coach was come in and basically punch like Jay Cutler in the mouth, you know, and like send him packing, like send all the old program packing. And he didn't do it to quite that degree in Las Vegas. But, you know, by the end of the year, he's already scapegoating Derek Carr. And believe me, I have piled on Derek Carr for quite a long time. For some reason, I'm blocked by his entire family on Twitter, even though I've like never tweeted at them or anything like that. Like Derek Carr is not going to be like the long-term solution for a franchise, but I didn't think he was the Raiders' problem last year. And I couldn't help but notice that John Gruden, of all people, like maxed out Derek Carr's efficiency. And the efficiency went way down under Josh McDaniels. And it just seemed like, again, he was repeating the old habits of thinking like nothing could be his fault. Like he's got to like make big moves, like bring in like his guys. And he brings in like his college roommate as his GM. He goes out. And the only thing he did was like a first year executive basically was trade for Devonta Adams. They didn't make like any draft picks or anything like that. And then, you know, then he sends away Darren Waller over seemingly like a very minor personal slight. I've been biased against Josh McDaniels for a long time because I always thought he was overrated in New England.
Yeah.
I suffered through his 1 year as offensive coordinator in St. Louis, where I thought it's like, man, this guy is nothing away from Belichick. And
yep.
I just think he is like the least introspective coach in the NFL right now.
Interesting. What's interesting is you mentioned Derek Carr. Derek Carr has moved on, and you have Dennis Allen above Josh McDaniels.
I do.
I
one
think
spot.
There's kind of a 1A, 1B situation here,
yes.
Or 31A, 31B situation here, as it were. But I hated Dennis Allen's tenure in Oakland, of which there wasn't much to work with, but it was just there was just no high watermark. There just wasn't anything. It was just that's always when I did you do any like you sometimes I'll see a bad coach and I'll say, did you do anything with it? Did you make a player better than he should have been? Whatever. And I just, when I was watching Dennis Allen, I was like, this just isn't working. The Saints last year, it didn't impress me very much. Any hopes for Dennis Allen with Derek Carr this year?
I'll say with Dennis Allen, the one thing he does do is he clears the lowest bar, where if you've got to take care of your side of the ball. Like, that's like just the bare minimum for what you have to do as a head coach. And Dennis Allen is a good defensive coordinator. The Saints defense was perfectly fine last year too. So he does like clear that bare minimum, but he's just so conservative. And when you're not working with a whole lot on offense, like he wasn't in Oakland the first go round, he wasn't last year with Andy Dalton. And now you have Derek Carr, who is an upgrade, but a very nominal upgrade. You've got to be a lot more aggressive. You've got to be like ruthless about finding and exploiting edges, and just nothing whatsoever in his head coaching tenure suggests like he's going to get aggressive and like basically make his own luck on offense. And that's why I've got him ranked down and basically in the will get fired zone. to your point with Dennis Allen, he won 41% of his games last year, and that was a career high for Dennis Allen. Doesn't seem to be the best head coach.
Mm. All right. I want to go through a three coach stretch here that I find fascinating because I think that they're correctly ranked, but they just seem like they shouldn't be next to each other. 20 is Brandon Staley. 21 is Mike McCarthy. 22 is Arthur Smith. There's a whole range here. The Arthur Smith blurb starts out with Arthur Smith fake sharp.
I don't say I agree with that. I said it's an article of faith on analytics Twitter.
Let's start with Arthur Smith. Like I keep seeing Arthur Smith's system as sort of this abstract thing. Oh, we need this guy for Arthur Smith's system, whatever. And I'm yet to see. And also, like, I saw Ben Volen tweeted this the other day. God bless him. But he was like, man, I think they're gonna regret not putting any Falcons games on primetime because if Ritter is at all good. And I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah, no.
What?
They did us a solid there by not doing
They
that.
Did us a solid. I just don't. I feel like we as a punditry are trying to move the Falcons along to a place that not even they think they're at.
It's Arthur Smith is like a weird conceptual like phenomenon like you were getting at where I do actually think he brings something. The Falcons were one of only five teams in the entire league to generate positive rushing EPA last year. Like he can really design a rushing attack. And you know, that was with like an offensive line that's not amazing, with a quarterback that wasn't taking any pressure off the running game. So he can create a rushing attack. So then if you can do that with like a day three rookie in Tyler Algier, like a journeyman slasher in Cordell or Patterson, why would you use the number 8 overall pick on Bijan Robinson, who is amazing? But like he's like Kyle Shanahan, where he can create a run game.
I was gonna say he's like the or a quarterback, where it's like the Trey Lance pick for running backs. Yeah. Where it's like you can create this out of nothing, and now you're spending capital on it.
Exactly. So he's like, I feel like he's really good at that. But then it's like he wants to trap himself in like the Ryan Tannehill box. Basically, he doesn't want to transcend the way he's had success. Like he made Ryan Tannehill a thing again. That's a pretty huge accomplishment.
What a miserable phrase, the Ryan Tannehill box.
Exactly. Like I feel like he has the power to transcend it, but he doesn't want to. And so like it's really good that he can design these good rushing attacks, but it's really, really bad that he doesn't want to think bigger.
Did you think about dinging Mike McCarthy even more? He's not even in the top 20 for saying that Kellen Moore got fired because he was trying to score points.
Too many points. And I mean, I put some of the infamous quotes in here. He called the 19-12 divisional round game with the 49ers a shootout. He literally said he didn't like getting into shootouts. So they got into a shootout with the 49ers. And like this one line's like a chat GPT line. Like I would put it in chat GPT. Like what is something like a really, really like retrograde coach would say? And it'd be that I don't want the number one offense. I want the number one team. And so Mike McCarthy's weird though, because he says and does all these extremely dumb things, but then they are coming. He is coming in. He's winning 12 games again, like 2 years in a row. And like the actions like aren't matching the words at all. Like clearly I'm not believing in Mike McCarthy ranking him as the 21st coach, but the reason he's 21 and like not 27 where McDaniels is because I guess I can't totally ignore that they're winning 12 games despite the extremely dumb things he's saying.
I'm no Kellen Moore evangelist. I just don't think that that's the problem. And I don't think Brian Schottenheimer is a solution.
No.
That's all.
And I don't think Mike McCarthy. So yeah, I mean, I guess Mike McCarthy's calling these plays. And
yes,
all I remember about the end days of Mike McCarthy in Green Bay were Packers fans basically saying like, I will stop watching sports if Mike McCarthy calls another slant. And then he did. And now they're all off Twitter. They've all stopped watching sports. They're in finance and banking now, thanks to Mike McCarthy.
F1. They're F1.
They're F1 fans now.
Where's Brandon Staley at this point? He's 19 and 15. He was 14th last year. He's now 20th. He had a, I would say, career-defining loss in the playoffs last year. What do we do with a problem like Brandon Staley?
I don't know, because it's weird, because he's had so many vivid failures of... It's like Denny Carter and I always joke, like, sure would be great if the analytics worked once. Because, you know, we both support the analytics.
Last year, he gave a very nice... I don't mean to denigrate them. He gave a very nice tribute to his social team when they got nominated for a Webby. But I just clipped the phrase, "We got nominated for a Webby," from Brandon Staley, and I send it to Solak and Ruiz whenever they do something galaxy brain, because it looks like Staley is saying, like, he himself got nominated for a Webby award. He's become more meme than man at this point.
He has. So he it's so hard to separate back from fiction from it, because he goes viral all the time for his analytics backfiring.
But
he does, or
just like, remember the year where it was like, he would just be like, Lamar Jackson is special, and people would be like, this is so insightful from Brandon Staley, the top mind in football. That to me was the backlash, in my opinion. It's like, we crowned him smartest man in football without any evidence of that. And so I actually think that I was probably unfair to him for a while, just as, again, as the more meme than man.
Yeah. Anyone who says analytics, we grade on a curve, but he does grade out fairly well in most, like, the decision-making metrics and, like, the EPA metrics, like some of the play sequencing metrics. Lenny's done a horrible job on his side of the ball, where, like, the Chargers defense is kind of loaded with talent. I mean, at least on paper, they've had injury issues, as they've been known to do in the Chargers organization. But he hasn't at all been like the boy genius defensive coordinator he was with Aaron Donald and Jalen Ramsey with the Rams. Like, to me, that's like the rear guard threat to him. So maybe the analytics stuff pans, especially now they've gotten rid of Joe Lombardi. They might actually cut Justin Herbert loose with Kellen Moore. He's not taking care of his business on his side of the ball. And that is just the quickest path to failure as a head coach. If you don't clear that bar, like, you handle your side of the ball, you will be getting fired.
Agree. I'm intrigued to see where it goes. And I will say one thing. It's not about football. Maybe it is. The Chargers have a great social team, and they do all these like digs at other franchises. Slightly surprised that nobody is, let's call it, dug back at the Chargers, where there's a lot to dig. If I'm the Lions and they're making fun of our little gambling ring, I've got a lot to bring up about the Los Angeles Chargers.
The Chargers don't play in a soccer stadium anymore, so that's good. And good point. You don't know where the Brandon Staley era is going. I think we can safely say it will get funnier. That's all we know.
More Webbies in the future.
his backdrop on his videos is just gonna be like a shelf full of Webbies, and people like, people said I failed as Chargers head coach. What do you say about this, huh?
Hey, there's another three coach thing I want to get to here. So Stefanski, McDaniel, Robert Saleh. Robert Saleh, good coach?
I don't know. This is like the needs more information zone. And Saleh was weird because they were going somewhere last year. And then Zach Wilson just made it impossible to evaluate the entire situation. And they didn't score a touchdown in any of their final three games. Very, very, very bad. But I feel like he has the leadership covered. And, you know, Joe Douglas is supplying these players, yes. But the Jets allowed 188 fewer points last year on defense. So where I thought Saleh was hired for defense and leadership, because he's not an offensive guy. He was hired for those two things. I thought those were there last year. But it's not like I pumped him into the top 10, though. I need more information. But I've put him, this is firmly in the needs more information zone for Robert Saleh.
Okay. McDaniel, I think, has showed proof of concept there. This is classic needs more information, which give him another year. Stefanski is in this weird zone. He's been the coach since 2020. He worked a miracle 1 year, winning a playoff game and making it seem normal. And obviously there are extenuating circumstances. And then they trade for Deshaun Watson, which I thought people were just going to hold their nose, but it was going to work. And it turns out it was a complete disaster. And this is really on, like, Stefanski's job is, first of all, Browns fans, a lot of them, maybe it's just small sample size of the people I follow, feels like Browns fans hate Kevin Stefanski for some reason. And maybe they blame him for some of the failures, but then I find him thoughtful in our interactions. I didn't parse the failures last year to a degree where I can say this was Stefanski, this was Andrew Berry, this was Deshaun Watson. It just gets all jumbled, and I just sort of say everybody was bad.
They were.
But I kind of feel like they can't get out of the Deshaun contract. Andrew Berry has shown that he's a pretty smart dude. If this bottoms out, kind of feel like Stefanski's staring down the barrel here, pal.
Yeah, he's going to be the fall guy. And if it bottomed out, he could be a mid-season fall guy in 2023. And I agree with you. I think Kevin Stefanski is really sharp. And sure, like, he's coasting on this one miracle still, but it was a large miracle, a very larger than a normal miracle, what he did in 2020. But it was very concerning what happened last year. And he was tasked with a really difficult challenge, changing the offense on the fly when Deshaun Watson comes back. So Jacoby Brissett, you're playing very conservative. You're playing very station to station. That's just what Jacoby Brissett is. And that's also what Stefanski's offense had been. Whereas Deshaun Watson, we know, is an elite passer and plays like a high-flying style of offense. And it's hard to flip the switch mid-season with those styles, but they just comprehensively did not do it. And it seemed like he had no idea how to use Deshaun Watson. They averaged fewer points with Deshaun Watson than Jacoby Brissett last year. Something that should not be possible. And again, it was a large challenge, maybe an unrealistic one, but one he failed very comprehensively making that switch.
I just want to say this. I was looking on Twitter to find something else for a discussion, and I saw this. Is there any discussion in sports history that seems more disconnected from the update before it and the update after it than the Arizona Coyotes arena development? Because I just saw there's a vote, and it just seems like every time I see an update on it, it has nothing. It is the complete opposite of what I just previously saw about it. And it's like, oh, they're locked out of their arena. Oh, they've signed a 2-year agreement to play at Arizona State. Oh, there's a vote today. And now it's like, man, that's one of those things where if it was any other sport, we'd probably make fun of it a lot more. Oh, yeah.
No, truly. All I know is anytime we see an update, it's like, wow, they're playing in an even smaller arena now. And they're playing in the Chargers stadium now.
They just removed 500 seats for no reason. They just said, we're good. We're good.
Like, wow, I didn't know you could play outdoors in Arizona, but okay.
Okay, I'm going to get mad at you. Zach Taylor, 12th.
Yeah, I mean, I know. That's kind of disrespectful, isn't it? Or is it too high?
It's your list. I mean, all right, here's the deal. It's they win. He's the play caller. If it was easy, everybody would do it. That's an organization that's really hard to win in. I always overrated Marvin Lewis because the Bengals, however cheap you think the Bengals are, they're cheaper. And so some of these updates on the NFLPA stuff is kind of shining a light on that. I think that what Zach Taylor has done has been pretty good. And I really don't think, like, yes, Joe Burrow is a culture changer, but part of this, and this is something I've said a million times, in order to maximize a culture changer like Joe Burrow, you have to let him change your culture. And there are people like who are worse coaches who would have said, no, Joe, I'm driving the bus here.
Say like Urban Meyer did at Ohio State and chased him away.
Exactly.
No, I'm saying where he chased Joe Burrow away at Ohio State.
What if he got drafted by the Jaguars?
Oh my gosh. So I think honestly Zach Taylor at 12, it does sound too low. I think it plays into the missing smarter concept where I think the state of coaching is just really, really good right now. And I started doing this exercise, I believe in 2014. It used to be half the list. Like, well, this guy's getting fired next year. Like this without a doubt, like after like eight or nine.
I used to call them pre-fired.
Exactly. Like right. After eight or nine. Just like,
what is this?
There weren't any good coaches left. Whereas now it's just a really, really, it's Andy Reid, Bill Belichick, McVay, yeah. Harbaugh, Tomlin, like even Pete Carroll, like, so it seems low for Zach Taylor, but it's just partly a product of the coaching product being very, very strong right now. And Zach Taylor used to letting Joe Burrow change the culture. He's just a guy who understands the mission where he got out of Joe Burrow's way. He's getting out of Lou Anarumo's way on defense. Another huge part of being a head coach is just knowing who to trust. He trusts his defensive coordinator. He trusts like his team leader. he does his part by calling the plays. I agree that he's actually becoming quite a success, where he was someone who was like pilloried by the fantasy community, especially his first few years on the job.
Mike Vrabel at 9, ahead of Doug Peterson and Pete Carroll.
I mean, he's been on the job 5 years. He's been a number one seed. He's beat Bill Belichick in the playoffs. He's made an AFC championship game. And he's done all this, I would say, basically without players. Like, they just haven't had a very good roster. A situation we saw come to a head where he basically won a power struggle against John Robinson. And I think they've just been a classic. The whole has been greater than the sum of its parts. And he's been dealing with like a shorthanded deck just a little too long. And that will catch up with you. It caught up with them last year where they were 7-3 and didn't make the playoffs. But I think he's like Harbaugh. I think he's like Belichick, where he's always finding edges. He's always adapting. He's always changing. And he just needs better players. He just needs better players.
I feel like there's a lot of that going around.
There is. We need more good players.
Speaking of, can I yell at you for a second? I find it totally wrong that, and I really like Nick Sirianni, but I find Nick Sirianni above Vrabel, Peterson, Carroll, whatever, Zach Taylor at 12. Like, there are, Nick Sirianni was handed the deepest and best roster in football. Howie Roseman is the best GM in football. I think it's hard. I think they're all bunched together. And so it's almost a distinction without difference. And I'm not going to say that Sirianni should be in the Mike McCarthy, Brandon Staley zone. I would never say that. But what I am saying is that I just say, are you maximizing what it is? And Vrabel is a good example of that. And Nick Sirianni maximized a roster that I think a lot about, like, how many coaches could have done that? And Nick Sirianni had a great regular season last year. You play the teams on your schedule, whatever. And then in the playoffs, he beat a bunch of teams he should have beaten. Again, I'm hugely impressed with what they've done. If it was easy, everybody would have done it, all that stuff. But I'm not ready to say he's the 8th best coach in football.
Well, it's funny when you say how many coaches could have done that. I'd say more than it used to be, because the coaches have gotten a lot smarter. But even now, think of how many coaches would have come into this situation in Philadelphia and just been like, I don't know what to do with Jalen Hurts. Like, I just can't do it. I'm sorry, sure. Howie. I can't do it. And, like, he got dealt this
we're going to bring back Nick Foles.
We're bringing in Jarrett Stidham.
Andy Dalton.
Yeah, it's Stidham season now in Philadelphia. And he was dealt an amazing hand, but he knew what to do with it. And he's proven so adaptable. He basically, midway through his first season in 2021, just changed the offense completely on the fly, where they were passing too much for the personnel they had in 2021. Mid-season, after that humiliation, I believe against the Bucks on Monday Night Football, he's like, we're becoming the most run-heavy team in football. And then they made the playoffs. And then last year, though, he flips the switch back. They get A.J. Brown. They have much better passing game personnel. It's not like they became like Mr. Passing Team last year, but way more than the year before. And so he's been dealt really great hands, but he, I think, has done an amazing job of maximizing what he's been dealt. And it's just kind of, too, like the ideal of what a modern coach should be. He's EPA-focused. He's forward-thinking. It's not just lip service to analytics. Like, it's real analytics with him. And all from the guy who really – he's, like, just a guy, as we know. There's no more just a guy coach. The press guy, he's, like, the most likely coach to have, like, oh, wow, yeah, that guy was in on student council with me in high school. I didn't really think he was that smart, but here he is coaching the Philadelphia Eagles. What do you know?
I will say this. If you're asking me to rank who his childhood friends would say wasn't that smart, Nick Sirianni would not be number one for me.
No.
It would not be number one.
You went to like three straight summers. You went to a Dave Matthews concert with him though.
Oh, 100%. All right. So, interestingly enough, when I was thinking about being a dumbass baseball fan, I was thinking about how coaching is, there's a curve there. It's like the meme where it's like dumb person believes this, smart person believes this, yes, and then like mediocre person believes the opposite, right?
Yes.
Coaches are just about wins and losses over a long period, and it all evens out, and you get to see over a career what a coach is, and there's usually very little doubt as long as they get a handful of seasons. As long as they get 6, 7, 8 seasons, you see enough where it's like, even with Belichick, we saw Cleveland, which you can, if you want to throw out, you can, whatever. We saw the We saw the 2008 season where they didn't have Brady with Matt Cassel. We've seen now with Mac Jones and Cam Newton. So we're seeing this a little bit. Kyle Shanahan, to me, is someone who's done it with so many different quarterbacks and so many different systems and so little excuses. And listen, he's had nightmare seasons. But what he does reliably is he takes a quarterback and he gives them a yards per attempt that is historically good relative to the competition. We know what this is. And that's why I think, you know, you have him fifth.
He
ahead of Mike Tomlin, which I can argue. I can do. I love Mike Tomlin. I think
I do too. Actually,
might deserve to be higher.
It's disrespectful for Mike. Every ranking is disrespectful. That's one of the secrets of the rankings.
How to go at your own list.
That's the secret of the rankings. Is every single one of them is disrespectful.
Do you get the same people I get, which is when you say something nice about Kyle Shanahan, people are like, oh, cool. Well, imagine if you won something. And it's like, okay. There's a weird anti-Shanahan Twitter thing out there, and I'm not really sure where it comes from. We know what he is. He's not the best coach in football, but there's nobody I'd rather have with my quarterback.
No, it's true. I really play into the anti-Shanahan narrative because he's just so irritating. Like, is really where that comes from, I think. And this is the example I use over and over again. Like, so people have heard me make the joke before, like, wow, you really needed to send Kyle Juszczyk into motion again there, huh, Kyle? Not sure that was entirely necessary. And, you know, he punts at the wrong times. He settles for so many field goals. So he's extremely irritating, as I think where that comes from. But I couldn't agree more with your analysis of Kyle Shanahan and someone who has just truly maxed out his scheme. And it's a really, really good scheme. And that's why I thought it was so interesting that he made the gambit for Trey Lance. Like, the guy who's known as like Mr. Conservative, kind of like made this huge, huge aggressive move up for Trey Lance. Cause I think he knew he had taken his system as far as it could go with scheme alone. And that was still almost beating the Chiefs in a Super Bowl. So it can take you all the way. But I think he knew that he just needed to get over the top. He needed someone more than just Brock Purdy or Sam Darnold or Jimmy Garoppolo. And so he made this aggressive swing, and then it just didn't work at all. So now it's really interesting to see him like back in the Purdy-Darnold zone. And
Purdy-Darnold zone.
Yeah, it's a strange place to be. But I totally agree. Kyle Shanahan is – no one is maxing out their scheme in the NFL more than Kyle Shanahan.
By the way, when I say nobody would want more with a quarterback, I mean a bad quarterback. I mean just like a quarterback off the streets. I don't mean like Andy Reid is the king of quarterbacks, and I'm not gonna get into that debate.
As we saw, they didn't have a quarterback who could throw in the NFC. I have faith in Kyle Shanahan that if Kevin Clark, you'd been covering the game on the sidelines, like whatever, that we were allowed to put Clark in now, that he could have schemed some completions for you at the very least.
I'm pretty bad at throwing things. I do not have a very strong arm. There are certain athletic things I am good at, and throwing is not one of them. All right, Harbaugh 4, McVay 3, whatever. Andy Reid nailed on number one. This is my number one question for you at the top here, and we do have to go and get to another guest. But Bill Belichick number two. How many seasons? And I think Bill Belichick is the best coach of all time. But we're talking about 2023 here. How many seasons of bleh will you see before you start knocking Bill Belichick down this list?
Well, this was the first year I didn't even have him number one. So even this is kind of...
It begins.
It has begun. It's kind of a surrender. But it's just so funny because like what has been like a cataclysmic 3 years for Bill Belichick, one of those seasons he made the playoffs with a rookie quarterback. And then the following season, when he has literally a defensive coordinator calling his plays, they're in the playoff hunt until week 18 and would have been in if they had just beaten the Miami Dolphins. And I just seem like more than anything, I don't think his football acumen has dropped off at all. He's still, to me, if I had to win a game this Sunday, I am picking Bill Belichick. But he just overconfident. Like he talk about, I've heard someone say before, Bill Belichick is in like the side quest era of his career where he's beaten the main portion of the game. He's like, oh, I'm going to have a defensive coordinator call plays and offense. Like, because I'm Bill Belichick. And it's almost like even Bill Belichick needed to be humbled a little bit.
The thing is, he was doing that stuff in 2008, 2009. Nobody noticed. Now people get mad at it. He's been doing weird stuff for a long time. He's been making weird draft picks for a long time when they were winning Super Bowls. He benched Malcolm Butler because he didn't like the way he looked in practice. Like, or there's some weird thing that nobody's ever, even Malcolm Butler, does know about. So It is. I agree. It's going to be. I don't think you can ever rank him outside the top five. I just think if they don't make the playoffs next couple of years, we can start the slide.
And he's just going to retire then. So he's just going to bail me out. I won't even have to face the Sophie's choice of Bill Belichick ranking.
That's right. And then Gerard Mayo will slide in and become your 18th ranked guy after 1 year. Roto Pat, we'll see you at Roto World. And thanks for coming on Sunday, buddy.
My pleasure, Kevin.
All right, Ben Fisher, staff reporter at Sports Business Journal. He covers the NFL. He's one of the best people to follow, to read in sports business, especially in the football space. What's going on, brother?
Hey, man, just living the dream. Lots of calls today. Happy to join you.
Lots of calls because there's been an ownership change, which doesn't happen that much. I have a couple of questions about that before we dig into Josh Harris, what the future of the Commanders is. And let's think about the template here of new ownership in the NFL and the two most recent examples, Denver and then Carolina. I think the question on every single Commanders fan's mind is how quickly can they get the Snyder stench out? And that means firing a whole bunch of people, hiring a whole bunch of people, getting rid of, if Snyder had any cronies left, I don't know. Getting the recording devices out of the facility, because I'm sure Snyder, you know, installed some somewhere. It's going to be a lot. There's going to be a new stadium, all of that stuff. But using the model of the last two, and obviously David Tepper's fired a hell of a lot of people, but timeline wise, how long does this take? Like, Josh Harris gets the team, control of the team. When are we actually going to see the start of whatever the Harris culture is?
You know, I wish I could give you a better answer, but I think if you look at the last few teams to change hands, it is a little bit hard to draw a direct line to it from a change in ownership to a division championship or multiple playoff wins. I think it's safe to say that I looked back even further to prepare for this conversation. Bills, Browns, Jags, Rams in the prior generation, all of these teams are generally better than they were before those ownership transactions. But are they a little bit better? Are they winning Super Bowls? Did it take 5 years? Did it take 2 years? Did it take 8 years? There's a lot of variability in those things. So if I were a Commanders fan, I would be very cautious about drawing a direct line from this development, as happy as we all are about it, to a championship at any given time frame. I think it's safe to say that in general, Washington will be a better run organization in a fairly short period of time. But exactly how that comes to bear, that depends on which draft pick you get, you know?
Well, the honeymoon is so funny because not Dan Snyder is such a huge upgrade. So in my opinion, there's going to be two waves of this. It's going to be not Dan Snyder operating like a competent franchise. And then after 3 years, if there's no winning, then the questions start. But I think that they're actually, the grace period is going to be longer because it's going to be general competence, actual repairs to the stadium, not putting your logo on the side of the plane and charging your own team for it. Like, I just think that there's just sort of basics and nuts and bolts you can literally in some cases install in that franchise, and it will look better almost overnight.
Oh, could not agree more. I mean, we're already seeing it now that, you know, accountants and people that value teams for a living, investment bankers, talk about goodwill and sort of that. And what is your brand reputation cost? And that's by definition a hard thing to say, but it was a negative number in Washington. There's nothing but upside for the Washington football team in terms of the wealth and size of its market, its historical fan base. You know, it's not exactly winning that many games, but it's not a total shambles on the football side right now. It's just nobody would dare be seen in a photograph with Dan Snyder. I mean, there were literally mayors in suburban Northern Virginia saying, I like this deal for the economics. This is a good deal for us to build a stadium here. I just can't be on the front page of the Washington Post with this man. And that goes away instantly. So while we talk about the time frames, from the Broncos and the Panthers and the Bills and the Browns, it is almost a completely unprecedented situation where day one, the team is worth more just because it's Josh Harris and not Dan Snyder.
Yes, the new stadium, obviously, we can get to that in a second. But my aunt and uncle were huge Washington fans, Washington football team fans. And I knew that Snyder was hated, and I knew that he was just universally unpopular, and he'd taken a crown jewel franchise and driven to the ground. And when you mentioned like the photo thing, there was an owners meeting in DC probably a decade ago, and I met my aunt for lunch, sorry, for breakfast at the Four Seasons of the Ritz or wherever they were. And Dana Snyder was right behind her and like walking in. And I was like, hey, look, the owner of your favorite team is behind you. And she was like, I'm not, I don't want to look at him. And I was like, really? Like, he's right there. And she's like, I'm not turning around. And it was just like, I thought she was joking, but it was actually vitriol. And it's like the idea, like Snyder had become so toxic that you're right. Nobody in Northern Virginia even wanted to have a meeting with him. Like, that's where it is. So the new stadium process, I guess, starts on day one because people are going to want to have lunch with Josh Harris because he represents a team that was one of the most popular teams in the world, you know, 1998.
Right. It goes from having zero bidders to three. The district, Maryland, and Virginia will all be very interested in doing business with them on a new stadium. And that's a hell of a good spot to be in if you want to make money.
Is the NFL have a preference, sir?
I think the NFL's preference is the best deal for the team. I think they there's a lot of nostalgia for the most public money. Yeah. The most public money. I think there's a lot of nostalgia for RFK, but if they can get 1.5 for Maryland and they're only going to get 500 million from the district or the feds, then they'll want it in Maryland. It's pretty bottom line oriented for the other 31.
Yes. And I the other thing about RFK, like the atmosphere, I was listening to Bill Parcells interview last year and he was talking about RFK in the late 80s and it sounded like it was on a different planet. You know, he was like, oh, you know how loud those crowds get at RFK. And I was like, listening to him, I'm like, no, I don't. I have no idea what you're talking about. Like by the time I started watching that team, they were at FedEx Field and nobody wanted to go mm-hmm. there and it was 45% Packers fans. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how that develops. Question for you about the price. It felt like, maybe I'm just stupid, it felt like there weren't that many serious bidders and yet the price was extremely high. Is this just the rate? Were there more bidders or lower price point that I don't know about?
No, I share your, I share your slight confusion, I guess, about that. because, well, first of all, this deal has been very odd in how inconsistent the information has been. I mean, look, it's all lots of background sources and people talking. Sometimes people's reporting and stories don't quite line up. I've never seen a situation where so many reporters who I otherwise trust are directly contradicting each other one way or another along the line here. So it's all a little foggy. And that's mostly because of how few people Dan Snyder really has in his inner circle. Very few people know what he's really thinking at any point. But I think you're right that, you know, economics, business 101 suggests if Josh Harris is paying 6.05, theoretically at least, somebody else was paying 6.04. You know, that's how an auction would work, but that's clearly not. There's been zero reporting to suggest that anybody else was even at six. Apostolopoulos out of Toronto was somewhere in the mid to high fives, and apparently so.
And there were some questions about him.
Well, lots of questions about him. And my inside people tell me that you know, neither one of those guys was ever particularly serious. It was always Harris's to lose. And that he was really bidding against himself. And what this was because of Snyder's position of saying, yeah, okay, maybe I'll sell, but I'll sell under the precise conditions available to me, you know, that I want. And he basically wanted six. So it was, he wanted a round number. He wanted to be darn sure if he was going to be essentially kicked out of the league, that he was going to, you know, have a nice big headline to celebrate.
What kind of owner is Josh Harris? Like, I know the process and we've seen him with the Sixers and he just fired Doc Rivers 2 hours ago. But like, what is the rep? What is the NFL expecting? Because one of the things about the NFL is they like a certain type of owner. And sometimes they don't get what they're thinking about and they always do the thing. I think it was Jimmy Haslam like met with Robert Kraft to figure out like how to run a franchise. And he didn't do anything that Robert Kraft did. Like, there's a certain profile they want an NFL owner. Like, what does the NFL think they're getting in Josh Harris?
Well, I think they really like that he's already in the Big Four world. You know, every sport's different, obviously. But I think they know that they've got a pretty good sense of how he operates things by his position with the Sixers and Devils. I know that the people that work for him, the high-level executives in Philadelphia and Newark, think very highly of him and say all the right things about, you know, how he runs his team. He's invested and engaged in what's going on, but he gives these people the room to work, which is, you know, micromanaging is always the death of any owner. The NFL really likes their owners to be very active and thoughtful and contribute to the league business when they can. I think that, you know, they should have very modest expectations for Harris to get too into league committee work at first. But, you know, the league is just fine with that because they'll all be very well enriched if he just fixes Washington. And if he has to back out of a couple of finance committee meetings to get things just right on a stadium in Washington, they're happy that that's where his energy is for the next few years.
That's a great point. And that's, we just read those stories like five times. The NFL owner is basically saying, whoa, it's Snyder. You took a hugely profitable crown jewel of the NFL and you've driven it into the ground and you're messing with our money now. And so Harris does not have that much of an uphill climb to get that reputation back. Washington wants to believe in that team again. They've gotten into other things and whatever, and they're more into the Capitals than they used to be. And the Nats obviously exist, which wasn't the case when during the Joe Gibbs era, when they were the biggest thing in the world. But it's not going to take a whole hell of a lot. I guess the question I have is he still going to be day to day with the Sixers, with the Devils? I mean, like, I remember, I thought there were some rules about owning other franchises, and then the Kroenkes own every single franchise on the planet. I guess it's in the same market. Right?
Away, I forget the exact time frame, but those
was
rules
a Kroenke
were
thing.
It was around then that those rules were changed. That was before I was on the beat, so I couldn't tell you. We'd have to find some other folks to tell exactly how that went down. But yes, it used to be against the rules to own other pro sports teams.
Even is there an expectation that he'll wean off the Sixers, or is the NFL fine with whatever?
You know, I mean, to be totally honest, I haven't asked anyone that question directly, but I think that, you know, they're fine with him owning those teams as long as, you know, he's got high quality people that will step in. I think in those situations, it's going to be particularly important that whoever Josh Harris selects to be the president of the Commanders, I mean, maybe that's Jason Wright. I don't know. You assume that a new owner would bring in his own people, but I think Jason probably stands a better chance than most of holding on to that job if he wants it under a Josh Harris era. It just becomes, as an owner's bandwidth is decreased, it just becomes that much more important that their president is a real top flight political operator too in that regard. And you've seen that around the league elsewhere where sometimes there's a bit of an ebb and flow over whether it's the owner or the president.
Next team for sale.
Well, I guess the official answer is the Seattle Seahawks,
yes,
who are freed from their obligation to give 10% of the proceeds of a sale of the Seahawks to the state of Washington in May of 24. Conventional wisdom for some time has been that Jody Allen's going to sell that team, the trust of Paul Allen will sell that team as soon as that sort of lockup period with the state ends. But a lot of people I talk to about this say not so fast. Jody enjoys owning this team, and that while it's technically illegal for a trust to own an NFL, not illegal, it's technically against the league rules for a trust to own an NFL team. If it's generally being well run, they're going to give a lot of leeway on it. That's what happened in Denver. People thought so highly of Joe Ellis that there were no particular hurry for the Bowling Trust to sell. So it's a mildly hot take to say that actually it's not the Seahawks. Arizona, far be it from me to presuppose the conclusion of the Michael Bidwell scandal, but I don't think it's a huge leap to think that could be another person who is quasi-forced to sell, depending on what's discovered.
Interesting.
Houston has been out there.
Ooh. You know?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to put too much stock in this as hard fact, but, you know, the team, Bob McNair was the man, and the team has not done well under Cal. It's a bit of a shambles there, and maybe he and his mom aren't that interested in owning the team, and maybe the rest of the family just as soon take the check. See, the size of the checks have changed so quickly that the calculation here changes. I'm sure that I don't think they want to, but I don't think you can ever take the Bears out of this conversation, given the state of the thing. Well, because, I mean, Virginia McClaskey is a very advanced age. I think the calculations and the interests of that family are a little bit more difficult to discern going forward after she's gone. And one presumes Kevin Warren was given a lot of pretty ironclad assurances about what the future looks like before he took that very powerful president and CEO job of the Bears, leaving the Big Ten for it, almost unheard of. But you know, I just think there's not a lot of cash sitting on the books in the McCluskey family. You know, a lot of generational turnover. No particular reporting to that end, but I think they've got to be on that list.
Hmm. Interesting. Not Tennessee. Once you get the new stadium,
they've settled some of that. Those ownership matters within the family. It's all been consolidated under Amy Adams Strunk to a point where I think the heat is off that as a possibility.
Chargers,
at least in the foreseeable future.
Chargers, anything? Remember there were lawsuits there.
I think. Not a lot of hard facts there. I think the Chargers would fit into the same category as the Bears, that, you know, it's not a cash rich team. There is hardly unanimity in the family as far as what the ideal future goes. And that when teams are worth $6 or $7 billion, those family splits can become more pronounced because just cashing out looks more and more promising than it ever used to.
That's the funny thing to me. It's like, you know, okay, George McCaskey, I'm sure he loves running the Bears. Well, you know, else he loves $7 billion, which if you wait a couple years, you might be able to get. Spanos the same way. I think that the calculus is changing so much. I think we saw that a little bit in the NBA after the Clippers sold for $2 billion or the Dodgers when they got their huge. I think that was in maybe $2 billion as well. Part of that was the TV deal, if you remember. But like once people see the price tag, they go, oh, wait, I didn't realize I actually don't like running this team. I like living in Monaco.
Right, exactly. And I think, and you know, I mean, part of me is a little feels a little bit guilty or reluctant to go too much into these family dynamics, because who really knows how two brothers get along with their mother or not. But the point is, here's a good example. When Pat Bowlen stepped down from day-to-day control of the Broncos because of his Alzheimer's disease in 2014, the future for his children was splitting, what, $1.5 billion seven ways? Mm-hmm. By the time they actually sold it, those seven children were splitting $4.65 billion seven ways, which is a very different thing. And while they might have said, okay, Brittany Bowlen, you're the younger sister here. We're gonna put you in charge because, you know, maybe we like owning the team and maybe we like, you know, this appreciating asset. 7 years later, you mean I can just take $150 million myself and never be heard from again? That sounds pretty good.
I'm open to that deal. If you're listening, anybody out there, I'm open to $150 million for never to be heard from again. I see baseball contracts like that sometimes. Just guys sent for $150 million. All right. Anything on the Snyder stuff that we aren't talking about enough to close loop on this conversation that you would bring up if I hadn't teed you up?
Yeah, I guess I would say that we have a deal everybody wants to get done in front of the league for final approval. And I certainly would not bet against this deal getting done. Motivations are strongly aligned. Nobody wants Dan Snyder there any longer than absolutely necessary. But it is a more complicated deal than the NFL owners are used to putting together. And because it's Dan Snyder, I would give a slightly higher percentage chance of this going sideways than I would with anybody else in this situation. So not to bum anybody out, but I feel like there is a caveat that needs said here, that the path forward is still a little bit tricky.
All right. He's Ben Fisher. He's the heir apparent to the Chicago Bears. He'll be purchasing them after this podcast is over. We'll see you, buddy. Where can we read your work? Plug your stuff.
I'm at sportsbusinessjournal.com and on Twitter is probably the best way, at Ben Fisher, that's SBJ. Right. Or if you see me walking around in Borough Hill in Brooklyn, you can say hi and ask me.
I moved out of Borough Hill. I'm out.
I was going to say I haven't seen you around in a while, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, I was in the mix there for a while, but now I'm out. I got a kid. It was loud. We had to get out of it.
It is loud. Yeah.
Didn't like my neighbors. My neighbors ended up, we had a shared courtyard, and two of our neighbors, someone sent this to my wife a couple months ago, two of them showed up on like a famous TikTok tour your apartments thing where people knock on doors. And their entire apartment was filled with crystals. So we were living next to roommates who were just, you know, we're crystal apartment people. So we didn't know that the whole time. Well,
it is Brooklyn. Energy. I mean, you're not far from the Dogs Only Bakery too. So, you know, you take.
I miss the Dogs Only Bakery. We're also not, we're not far from the Brooklyn Nets, of which there's no evidence that we lived four blocks from a National Basketball Association team.
No, that's a weird vibe around there, right? Like, you know, they're playing, but like, it's, unless you're taking the point.
My story about that is when I first moved there, I had to go, I was buying stuff and I was like, I just need a new iPad. And so I went to go buy an iPad at that Target at Atlantic Terminal. And I get back and it's like the second quarter of a Nets playoff game. And I was like, wait a second. I was across the street from like a pretty big, I think it was the Nets Celtics series. I was like, I was across the street from a playoff game in the NBA. And I just didn't see any evidence of it. So that's it. That's living in Brooklyn.
Hey, that
Kevin Durant.
Yeah, this is Kevin Durant. All these weird people in Brooklyn, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, it's a weird place to live, but I enjoy it. But that reminds me, actually, relevant. We checked the box off a nationally distributed podcast talking about New York neighborhood stuff, so that's good. But relevant to the Snyder thing, you talk about his personal goodwill. Did you see what the Bowie Bay Sox are doing, the minor league team?
I did not.
I think it's like next Friday. It's a change in ownership celebration night. Anyone named Josh or Harris gets in free. The Bowie Bay Sox. Hand of God.
My brother, I love that stadium.
Got his friend in Bethesda named Josh. He's like, we're going to go. It's going to be great. So that's what Josh Harris is with.
The smartest minds in America are in minor league marketing.
Yep. Completely true.
Ben Fisher. Anyway. I'll see you, buddy. Thanks for coming on Sony's Day.
Thanks, Kevin.